Welcome to Pulp Tales, fascinating stories of the pulp magazines and the creative minds that brought them to life. The fictioneers, the artists, the editors, and others. Brought to you by the PulpNet. Learn more about the pulp magazines through articles, blogs, bibliographies, links, over 100 episodes of this podcast, and much more at the PulpNet. Your link to the pulp magazines for almost 30 years. Online at ThePulp.net.
Mencken was quoted in a letter to somebody he wrote. He said, "Our new louse, the Black Mask, seems to be a success. The thing has burdened both Nathan and me with disagreeable work. Reading manuscripts for it is a fearful job, but it has kept us alive during a very bad period."
In this episode of Pulp Tales, Ed Hulse, publisher at Morania Press, and longtime pulp collector Walker Martin discuss the early years of the classic detective pulp magazine, Black Mask. This Pulp Tales was recorded at Pulp Fest 2024 in Pittsburgh on Thursday, August 1st, 2024. Ed begins.
So we're going to talk about Black Mask, the early years. Now, Black Mask was not the first detective pulp magazine. That honor goes to Street & Smith's Detective Story magazine, which started in 1915 and was kind of an outgrowth of Nick Carter Weekly. But it was an almost instantaneous success. It was also, besides being the first all-detective magazine, it was the first pulp magazine devoted specifically to one genre. And it was very important for that reason. So obviously there were imitators. Black Mask started, and the name H.L. Mencken was mentioned. He was partners with George Jean Nathan. They were two of the great literary lights of that era. And they had gotten into magazine publishing. And their pride and joy was a magazine called The Smart Set, which was very Tony, very sophisticated. But it never made a lot of money. So in order to keep The Smart Set alive and further some of their own publishing ambitions, they started some what they considered to be very low-rent popular fiction magazines that would appeal to a less sophisticated audience. So they came up with Black Mask. They said, well, if Street & Smith magazine's doing well, we'll do Black Mask. Being the snobs that they were, and there was probably no bigger snob on the planet than H.L. Mencken, they hated it from the beginning. Now, initially, to get the thing going, they did read manuscripts, which is why it's easy to think that Mencken was the editor. But in fact, as Mike pointed out, the first editor was a woman named Florence M. Osborne. Now, somebody somewhere along the line thought that it probably wasn't a good idea to reveal that a woman was the editor of this magazine with all these blood-curling stories of murder and mystery and mayhem. So she did not use the name Florence on the masthead. If you see the name on the masthead, it's F.M. Osborne is credited as the editor. So the first issue came out in April of 1920, and it was a successful, it didn't set the world on fire exactly, but it was successful pretty much from the beginning. And they imitated the detective story formula to a great extent. And they had some oddball sleuths, one of whom was mentioned, Matt Mooring of Steger Books has just published a collection about Reverend Galt, who was, his adventures were written by J. Paul Souter, who was not one of the legendary pulp writers by any means, but he was a good journeyman fictioneer. So his Reverend Gaunt, to give you an idea of how wacky some of these things were, he had gone to seminary, but he had also inherited a fortune. And he had other pursuits. He spent most of his time in a hunting lodge. But somewhere along the line, he had developed the skills of a private investigator. So he is one of the sleuths who's solving crimes in the pages of Black Mask. Well, it was a ridiculous series. Souter is not one of the great writers. I'm sorry, Matt. I hope this doesn't hurt sales of your book. But anyway, this was the kind of thing they were doing. And the early contributors, if you look at lists of the contents of the first couple or 3 years of the magazine, they're people that you would see in many magazines of the same period, like Anthony Rudd, who later became not only a detective story writer, but an editor of detective pulps, Hamilton Craigie, C.S. Montagna, Harold Ward, Christopher Booth, who was a very prominent detective story magazine contributor, Vincent Starrett, who was a very renowned critic. He created his own detective character called Jimmy Lavender, who I believe did not appear in Black Mask, but he contributed stories. And George Allen England, even, the guy who's most famous for his future science fiction novel, Darkness and Dawn, he was even a contributor to the early Black Mask. And it was mostly very, very English style whodunits. A lot of murders and robberies committed in English country homes with, you know, Lord and Lady, what's his name, and Lord and, you know, whoever, and they're gathered around, and it's a garden party, and there's a corpse falls out of the closet, that kind of thing. Not a lot of action, what we would consider detective action, but also because pulps were intended for more of a working class audience and not terribly intellectual readers, they didn't have the kinds of puzzles that you would find in contemporary novels by detective people. So the stories really didn't please on any level. And Mencken and Nathan hated it from the beginning. Now, Mencken was quoted in a letter to somebody he wrote, he said, "Our new louse, the Black Mask, seems to be a success. The thing has burdened both Nathan and me with disagreeable work. Reading manuscripts for it is a fearful job, but it has kept us alive during a very bad period." And apparently they hated it so much that even though it was making them money in the short run, the first year of the magazine was not yet over when Mencken and Nathan sold it to a guy named Eltinge Warner, who was a smart set investor, whose most successful magazine at the time was Field and Stream. That was the basis of his success originally. His company was called Pro Distributors Publishing Company, and he took over the magazine happily. Mencken and Nathan gave it up happily. But things didn't really change a lot. The fiction remained pretty much the same. The difference was that Florence Osborne washed out after the September 1922 issue. She was replaced the next month by a guy named George W. Sutton. He became editor with the October 1922 issue. So Sutton, at least technically, deserves credit for some of the big changes in Black Mask because it was on his watch, while he was technically the editor of the magazine, that the hard-boiled detective story was born. And of course, that's what Black Mask would become most famous for in the next few years. So, for example, Three Gun Terry in the May 15th, 1923 issue, a story written by Carol John Daly, is now considered the first hard-boiled detective. You could make the case that other detectives in other magazines and other tough guys like Adventures Don Everhart by Gordon Young, you could make a case that they were pretty hard-boiled too. But technically speaking, it's Three Gun Terry who's the first guy. Now, Daly followed up in the very next issue, June 1, 1923, with another hard-boiled private investigator called Race Williams. Now, Race's first adventure was called Knights of the Open Palm, and it appeared in that KK issue, which Walker has recently revisited. So at this point, Walker, tell us something about Race Williams and about the other stories in that issue.
Okay. I first read this issue about 50 years ago. I don't remember anything about it, except it was pro and con to KKK. Now, this may seem like an outrageous thing, but in the 1920s, the Klan was very popular. I still remember a documentary showing either New York City or Philadelphia where the Klan marched down the empty streets, rank after rank, dressed in their white sheets and hoods, silent, scary as hell. Black Mask decided to do this issue showing the Klan member right on the cover. And I would have to say this is one of the most iconic issues of any pulp ever made. And in fact, if you, it's very rare, if you could find a copy of this, it's worth a lot of money. Now, this particular issue, I plan on having it slabbed real soon. It's white paper, it's mint condition. In a couple of years, I'm sure I'm going to get thousands of dollars for a magazine that I paid peanuts for. So be prepared. It's coming.
So what was your opinion of that first Race Williams story?
Okay. Knights of the Open Palm. First Race Williams, private eye story, and he is against the Klan. Kills four of them. Not that interesting as a story. Race brags too much. Race had this annoying habit of speaking directly to the reader. You know, he would stop the story dead and all of a sudden start saying, well, you think I maybe shot this guy in the head too fast? You know, he would speak right to you. This particular story I thought was very mediocre. Then I read Ray Cummins' story, T. McGirt, Klansman. A criminal joins a Klan and steals money. Again, not favorable to the KKK. The next piece was Call Out the Klan, Peterson. This was the best story in the book. Terrible review of the KKK. He pointed out the fact that the Klan actually hated Jews, hated Catholics, hated all minorities, and the only ones they didn't hate were white Protestants. Then you got the color of honor. Another Klan story. He joins off and starts killing people. These stories didn't make any sense really to me, and I didn't particularly like this particular issue. But definitely, you can try to get the replica. I looked on abooks.com and didn't see any copies for sale. So even a replica is probably rare.
Well, what was your sense? I mean, do you think that somebody who was reading that magazine in 1923 would have guessed that Race Williams would become the star of the magazine?
No way, because he became very popular, of course, with the readers, but this first story did not impress me at all.
So actually, even though George W. Sutton was the editor at this time, it's kind of a fluke that he was on vacation when Daly submitted this first Race Williams stories, and it was actually purchased by the assistant editor, whose name was Harry North, and he bought not only the first Race Williams story, but the aforementioned Three Gun Terry story while Sutton was on vacation. Well, Sutton came back, he read these stories, and he called Daly into his office, and he said, I gotta tell you something, I hate your stories. So I don't like them at all, but the readers do, because we've just gotten the sales figures in, and these books have gone through the roof. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but that was the deal. So he said, if you keep writing them, I'll keep buying them. So, like I say, Sutton gets the credit or the blame, depending on how you feel about Race Williams, but the point is, in Race, Daly had created kind of a modern-day Western gunfighter, because Race famously called himself a halfway house between the crooks and the cops, which meant that he had his own form of rough justice. He was not there to administer the law. He was strictly a shoot-em-up guy. He would just as soon shoot crooks as bring them in, get them apprehended by the police. So in that respect, he was kind of like one of these old-fashioned gunfighting heroes of Western fiction, you know, who had their own personal code, but yet operated outside the law and outside the kind of civilized norms. But again, Sutton didn't like him, but he said he'd continue to buy Race Williams. I can only imagine what he said to Harry North, you know, like, what were you thinking? Because he had that much of an aversion to Race Williams. Interesting, Harry North also discovered another mainstay of Black Mask's early years who became one of the magazine stars, Earl Stanley Gardner, the lawyer who started writing fiction in the early 20s to supplement his meager income as a defense lawyer of predominantly poor, often Chinese individuals in California. And he had a lot of ideas, some of them based on his own experiences with the law, and he started submitting pulp stories. Well, he apparently submitted quite a few, to black mask, which were all turned away. But again, Harry North, rather than George Sutton, discovered something about Gardner that he liked, and he bought the first story that Gardner had published in Black Mask. Once again, Sutton questioned his acumen in terms of selecting stories, but Gardner continued submitting. He had a lot of rejections early on, but he kept placing stories, and finally he caught on with the reading public. So you can imagine that George Sutton was probably not happy, you know, that guys he would have turned away cheerfully were turning out to be relatively successful authors for the magazine. That may have been one of the reasons that he left, because 1924, he was replaced by a guy named Phil Cody, who'd actually come from the business side of the magazine and was not particularly thrilled to be named editor. But when Sutton left, Eltinge Warner, the publisher, said, look, we need somebody to fill the breach here, at least temporarily. Now, the one thing that we can say for Sutton before he left that he did do that did have a major impact on the magazine in these early years, in 1923, he bought the first story submitted by Dashiell Hammett, who was a tubercular former Pinkerton operative who started writing stories and who brought to his work not only a sincerity and a fidelity to actual detective procedure, but he also helped pioneer a writing style that was just beginning to become popular, a very terse, direct writing style that involved action through character and various scenarios that he had developed that from his own experiences, and he placed his fictional characters. His main character, of course, was called the Continental Op. He was never given a name, but he was an operative for the Continental Detective Agency. And of course, Hammett was very fastidious about his work. He wrote and rewrote and rewrote his stories. He was a great craftsman. He was not a penny a word hack. And even though he probably made less money in the long run than most of the regular contributors, his stories became a very high form of this type of hard-boiled literature. And so the actions of the character matched the style of his writing. So Cody worked on Black Mask. He was the editor until the fall of 1926, which is when Captain Joe Shaw took over the editorship of the magazine and really made it what it was. Now, Shaw gets a lot of credit. He deserves a lot of credit. A lot of people who have issues with Shaw point to the fact that George Sutton and Phil Cody actually bought the first stories of a lot of the writers who became very popular under Shaw's editorship, guys like Frederick Neville and Raoul Whitfield and many of the others. But it was Shaw who saw the potential of the Hammett style and recognized that, just like Hemingway's style in mainstream fiction, that it was a vibrant, new, fresh, it didn't have the purple prose aspect that a lot of pulp fiction did. And he deserves credit, but he also deserves a little blame, because as Hammett got to be really big and wrote his novels, first Red Harvest, then The Dane Curse, and then of course his two best, Maltese Falcon and The Glass Key, Shaw more or less insisted on remaking the entire magazine in Hammett's image and likeness, so that the hard-boiled style was more or less forced on the other writers. Earl Stanley Gardner in particular resented it, and he was very bitter toward Shaw, so much so that in 1946, when Shaw edited what would be the first hardcover anthology of hard-boiled pulp fiction, Gardner refused to be represented in its pages. Shaw was popular, and he did increase the circulation of the magazine from 66,000 copies per issue to 80,000 copies per issue in his first year. And he took the circulation to a high of 103,000 copies a month by 1930. It was not long after that he lost Hammett, but he still had Neville and Daly. By the way, Short, should be noted, just like George Sutton before him, did not like Daly's work and would just as soon not have used them. And he did not recognize Daly as a talented writer in the mold of Hammett and Neville and some of the others. So, and yet, because Race Williams was such a reader favorite, he adopted the same attitude. You keep writing them, I'll keep publishing them. Unfortunately, Shaw's insistence on adhering very rigidly to a certain style may have been responsible for the magazine's drop in circulation, because as the Depression took hold, the circulation kept sliding, especially when popular publications in late 1931 introduced Dime Detective Magazine, which used a lot of the same writers that Black Mask had developed. And by 1936, the circulation was barely 60,000, which means there was a net loss of readers and revenue in the 10 years that Shaw edited the magazine. Now, chronologically, we'll leave the discussion there because the magazine went through different editors and it was sold to Popular Publications in 1940. That's a subject for a whole other panel. But now I'm going to turn it over to Walker, who, for those of you who don't know, and we've done several Black Mask panels together over the years, so you've probably heard this before, Walker was one of only two people that we know of who have compiled complete sets of Black Mask magazine, which especially in these early issues that we were talking about, very, very difficult to obtain. But Walker, why don't you tell us a little about how you got involved in collecting the magazine and how you found out about your chief competitor and some of the strange things about that relationship.
Sure. From about 1956 to about 1966, that 10-year period, I was strictly a science fiction magazine collector. Then I had the misfortune to be drafted into the Army in 66, and that ended my collecting career for 2 years. When I got out of the Army, I had discovered Ron Goulart's book, The Hard-Boiled Dicks, and it was full of praise for Black Mask, and I made up my mind the first thing I was going to do when I got out of the Army was to try to complete a set of Black Mask, and that's what I started on in 1968 when I got out. I saw Jack Irwin's name in the Fantasy Collector or something. He had some ad, and I didn't know him until I saw his name there saying he's in Trenton, New Jersey. So I took a ride over to his house and bought the 5 copies of Black Mask that he had. He had 5 issues from the 30s. And I made the misfortune of praising a magazine so highly that I created my own competition. Jack started collecting a magazine also. And the two of us went crazy in Trenton, New Jersey, trying to buy every issue we could. I sent out hundreds of letters to all sorts of science fiction collectors, and slowly, bit by bit, the magazine started rolling in, and I managed to complete a set of all 340 issues. Today, I would say that's probably impossible because so many people are interested in Black Mask and it's so expensive. For instance, I paid like $2 or $3 each for most of the issues that I got back in the 60s and 70s. Nobody was collecting it, and people were glad to dump their issues off on me. Now, you can't even get these issues for $200 or $300 each, never mind $2 or $3. Going through the dealer's room today, I noticed several tables having issues of Black Mask, pricing them $600, $700, $800 each. So it's going to be very hard for anybody to complete a set. So Jack Irwin and I both had complete sets in Trenton. And around 1975, we got a phone call from a man by the name of Herbert Room. And Herbert was a literary professor in New York City somewhere. He knew nothing about the pulps, knew nothing about Black Mask. He was not a collector. And he didn't know what to do because he had been commissioned to do this book on Black Mask and do a collection of stories. Yet he had no idea who to put in it. But evidently he found out from Ron Goulart that Jack Irwin and I both had complete sets. So the first thing Herbert Room did was visit us for several days off and on for a period of a few months. He would go over to Jack's house and sit there all day reading the magazine. Then he'd come over to my house and do the same thing. I didn't dare lend him any magazines to go home with and read, because I know I'd never see him again. So he had to read them in the house. And he finally he gave up because he didn't like Pulp Fiction. Isn't that strange? How did this guy get the commission to do a book on Black Mass? Well, he's a literary professor. His expertise was Henry James. He did several collections of stories by Henry James. And you can't get more literary than Henry James, that's for damn sure. So Herbert Room asked us for our opinion. Now I told him, he especially wanted something from the early 20s, but I told him it's hopeless. You know, you got Dashiell Hammett, and maybe you want to have a story by Carol John Daly because he was influential. But that was it. I couldn't recommend anybody else. And Jack Irwin was a big expert on Earl Stanley Gardner, so he recommended Gardner, George Harmon Cox, and a couple others. And I recommended Torrey and Rare Whitfield, and of course Hammett and Chandler. Jack recommended Lester Dent, I remember that. And then I recommended Merle Consinor, the Turkey Buzzard Blues. Now at first, Herbert Room didn't want to print the Turkey Buzzard Blues because it's 70 pages. And when you're doing a collection of like 300 and some pages, you don't want to have a 70 page story in there. But this story was so good, he agreed with me that it had to be in the book. So the book eventually came out, and Herbert Room followed our suggestions mainly, except for the last four stories by William Brandon, Kurt Hamlin, Paul Fairman, Bruno Fischer. These are not Black Mask authors, but Herbert Room wanted to put some short stories in there, so he finished up the book at the end with these guys. They're just not Black Mask authors. A couple years later, after the book came out, Herbert Room called me up and he said he had all the correspondence where he had contacted the writers to get rights or the widows, you know, and he wanted to sell this correspondence to me. And I'd be glad to get it, you know? And so I said, what do you want for it? He said, $1,000. Now in 1975, $1,000 is like $7,000 or $8,000 in today's money. No way in hell I'm going to give him that much money. So I managed to get him down, but he wouldn't go down below $600, which was still more than I wanted to pay. So I often wonder what happened in that correspondence, because Room has been dead for a long time now, and I've never heard what happened to the correspondence, which was quite extensive to different Black Mask authors. In addition to this book, if you want to collect Black Mask, it's hopeless trying to get the issues. Like I said, they're too expensive and they're very rare. You can get the Hardboiled Omnibus, which was edited by Joe Shaw, or you could get Ron Goulart's The Hardboiled Dicks, or you can get this book, The Hardboiled Detective by Herbert Room. But the best book is by Otto Penzler, edited. It's called The Black Lizard, Big Book of Black Mass Stories. That's quite a mouthful, I can't even say it. This book is over 1,100 pages long, has 53 stories in it, mostly novel at length, and it's an enormous book. It's something you got to get. It's only $25 on Amazon. Otto Penzler also did a book called The Black Lizard, Big Book of the Pulps, which had over 30 stories from Black Mask, and the rest of the stories were from Dime Detective, Detective Fiction Weekly, and a couple other magazines. But that's another thing you want to do. And also, right here at the convention, if you go to Mike Chomko's table, you'll see a lot of books by Steger Books. Matt Morian has been putting out tons of stuff about Black Mask. So you want to go to Mike Chomko's table, or you want to go to stegerbooks.com, and Matt has a website, so you can buy some Black Mask stories, you know, from that source. Okay, you got something else?
Well, the one thing I have to say, Walker, and I've heard the story so many times, I have to point it out. you, in journalistic parlance, you buried the lead, because the most interesting thing about Walker's collecting of the magazine, think about the mathematical odds that you've got this legendary pulp magazine. And by the way, even in institutions and educational, UCLA, for example, had considerable holdings in Black Mask, but even they didn't have a complete set. Frank Gruber went to them when he was researching his book called The Pulp Jungle, and he was surprised at how much they were missing. But the point with Walker's deal is that Walker was, with his fellow Trenton resident Jack Irwin, just think about the probability of this important magazine that in the entire world, forget about the country, the entire world, the only two guys who were able to amass complete sets lived in the same town in New Jersey. That's freaky enough. Now take those odds and multiply them by a couple of million, whatever, that when they were completing their sets, both of them needed the same issue at the same time to complete their sets. Why don't you tell them about that?
Yeah. We both reached a point where we had all the issues except one issue, and it happened to be the same issue for both of us. So that made me realize there's something wrong with that issue. It's either distributed and the warehouse burnt down and there were no copies distributed, or some type of flood. Something happened to that issue. I think it was October 1922. It took me a long time, but I finally tracked it down. Jack Devaney had a copy, and he had a little mini auction between Jack, me, Gene Zambolis, and some other guys. And I was the winning bidder. I was determined that nobody's going to get that issue because that completed the set. So I got my last issue from Jack Devaney. Actually, competing, like Jack Irwin and I competed to such an extent, it ruined the friendship. We were friends before we really started collecting Black Mask, but once we started on Black Mask, all gloves were off. You know, he tried everything he could to get any copy ahead of me. Like he found out about a guy called E.H. Mundell who had a couple hundred issues. When he got the couple hundred issues from E.H. Mundell, I was so jealous, I could have killed him. If I could. The only reason I didn't kill Jack Irwin is because I knew I couldn't get away with it. Because if you're going to kill one Black Mask collector, who are you going to go to? I had the perfect motive. You know? So it ruined the friendship. And for decades after that, Jack and I didn't have too much to say to each other, even though we lived in the same city. Jack died a couple years ago, and he had sold his Black Mask collection to Otto Penzler. Now, I think the amount was $40,000, and Otto sold it to a Japanese collector where it disappeared into the vault of some Japanese collector, or I don't know what happened to it. I hope it hasn't been lost. And I had my set for about 30 years before I disposed of it. And the reason I got rid of my set was I read all the Joe Shaw issues, which were my favorite period during the 30s. But after a while, he became too tough, too hard-boiled. You know, he needed more humor. He needed humor like the Devil's Suit, if you ever read that story that Shaw, it's hilarious. But for the most part, Shaw did not have a sense of humor, not that much, really. The best period and the revival period, I would say, would be 1940, 1951, when Poplin Publications took over. And that panel will be tomorrow at 7:45 by John Woolley, John Gunnison, and John McMahon. They're going to talk about that period. And that's one of my favorite periods, too. A lot of humor, a lot of complicated stories, nice long stories. It's a different type of magazine. But the Poplar Publication period is a great period. On Saturday night, John Woolley will be talking to Peter Wolfson, who is the son of Morton Wolfson, who created Peter Page for Black Mask and Dime Detective. Well, he wrote under the name Peter Page. And what else?
That's it?
Can't think of anything else. Are there any questions?
Yeah, we got time for a few questions.
John.
Yeah, could you talk just briefly about the other stories besides the detective stories that Peter Black Mask early on?
Yeah.
There were other genres, I know.
In the early period of Black Mask from 1920, especially to 1926, Black Mask was mainly a sort of general interest adventure magazine. They published westerns, adventure fiction, detective mystery also, but it wasn't strictly a detective magazine. If you wanted just strictly detective stories, then that would be Street and Smith's Detective Story Magazine, which was very popular, came out every week, but it was not a hard-boiled magazine at all until maybe the late 30s and the 40s. It started to introduce some more hard-boiled stories in the Street and Smith Detective Story Magazine under the editorship of Daisy Bacon when she took over the magazine. The early issues are expensive and rare. I don't know there's that much in them to read except Hammett. And Hammett's one of the great names to come out of the pulps, and so is Raymond Chandler. If you want to pick the two best guys to come out of the pulps, they're certainly in the running. And it's amusing to think of Herbert Room. He didn't even know about these guys. And one time, Herbert and I were talking about Henry James, who happened to be one of my favorites also. And finally, Herbert stopped and looked at me and said, "Look, I see you like Henry James. Why do you read this pulp junk?" And that's what he called it, junk. And I said to him, "You know something, Herbert? There's such a thing as a good pulp story. There's some good pulp literary stories out there. It isn't all junk." But not being a collector or a reader of pulps, he didn't know what I was talking about.
Getting back to John's question, there were, as we said, even though Shaw's energy was directed mainly towards the Hammett-type style of detective story, westerns were enormously popular by the late 20s. Westerns, the western was a thriving genre where there were dozens of western magazines, but there were also World War I aviation stories. So for example, the legendary Horace McCoy, who became again a giant of mainstream American literature, for Black Mask he wrote a series about an aviator named Jerry Frost who patrolled the border looking for drug smugglers and whatnot. There were several detective characters, and Eugene Cunningham, one of the most popular Western authors of the pulps, actually did some westerns for Black Mask, as did Earl Stanley Gardner, I think. And so there was some variety, and precisely because these things were so popular, I believe this was Eltich Warner's doing. He insisted that periodically that there would be detective figures on the cover, or detective figures, cowboys on the cover, simply because the westerns were so popular, and he felt that having cowboys on the cover would help sell the magazine. There were also a couple of prize fight stories. I can't remember exactly which ones, but I did read some of those. And Thompson Burtis, who was another guy who did a lot of aviation stories, he had a series in Black Mask. So, and occasionally you had aviators on the covers. But if it had been entirely up to Shaw, I think that he would have stuck with the kind of detective characters, the guys in trench coats and fedora hats that we kind of associate with the Black Mask iconography. So certainly it's an area that needs more explanation. We have time for one or two more questions. Yeah, in the back.
Two things. Were there any good Western detective stories that came out of that? And secondly, in the aviation, Woodfield's book, I forgot that he's aviation, I'm blanking on the name of the book, was that serialized in Black Mask? I think it's Wings of, I forgot Woodfield's book, but I know I have it, but I forgot the title.
I don't know, you don't know the answer to that?
Yeah, Woodfield did do sort of a serial or some stories connected together about aviation. As far as good westerns, there was some hard-boiled western fiction, but I can't think of anything.
In terms of the fusion of the western and the detective story, The best one really is W.C. Tuttle's Hash Knife Hartley, who started out in Adventure Magazine, later went to Doubleday Short Stories magazines. And Hash Knife and his partner Sleepy Stevens were, you know, these kind of wandering cowboys without any portfolios, so to speak, but they would invariably wind up in, you know, feuds between ranches, and somebody would get murdered and the wrong guy would get framed for the crime, and Hash Knife, using approved detective, you know, methods of detecting, would ferret out the killer, and they'd have, of course, the typical Western gunfight at the end to try. But those are excellent stories, by the way. They're stories that really should be reprinted, because at their best, they're as good as anything that, you know, the detective pulps had.
Yeah, Rob Sampson wrote a lot about those.
Yeah, yeah. One more question. I'm sorry, Walker.
Yeah, one more funny story about Joe Shaw. What he decided to do to Hard-Boiled Omnibus in 1946, he had to get the permission from the writers to reprint certain stories. And he contacted Fred Neville, because Neville was one of the big writers in Black Mask, and wanted to reprint one of Neville's stories. And Neville said, absolutely no. For some reason, Neville thought his slick work and his novels were way better than his Black Mask stuff. And he is completely wrong, because the stuff that's been reprinted is his pulp stuff. The slick stuff is dying in the old slick pages. You never see a collection of Neville's slick stories. And his novels, he had three novels, so he wasn't a big novelist either. Later on in his life, he did some stories for Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. And by the way, another thing I want to point out about Hammett, Ellery Queen took Hammett's stories, and for many years we were not aware of it, but the Ellery Queen was chopping these stories up, deleting words, changing paragraphs of Hammett's stuff. And nobody was aware of this for a real long time, till all of a sudden it started to become apparent that something was going wrong with the whole way Ellery Queen handled Hammett. Not only in the reprints in Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine, but also in the Jonathan Press Digest or Mercury Press Digest collections that they were putting out. These stories are butchered. So if you want to read Hammett the way he should be read, a couple years ago, a big paperback collection came out called The Complete Continental Op Stories. And that's the one to get, because they're not cut up or chopped up at all.
I think that's it. Well, thank you very much for sitting in. We hope you enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Pulp Tales, fascinating stories of the pulp magazines and the creative minds that brought them to life. Brought to you by The Pulp Net. Learn more about the pulp magazines through articles, blogs, bibliographies, links, over 100 episodes of this podcast, and much more at The Pulp Net. Your link to the pulp magazines for almost 30 years. Online at thepulp.net. Subscribe to Pulp Tales on your favorite podcast platform, or listen to us on the web at thepulp.net. If you enjoy our content, please like us or leave us a review. And tell your fellow pulp fans about Pulp Tales. Thank you for listening, and keep reading the pulps. Pulp Tales is copyright 2024 by William P. Lampkin.